Session number 6131, Real One.
Commander Dredge, Real One. Yes?
I thought you said Major.
No, Commander. Well,
I'm a little bit deaf, you know.
Okay. Could I ask you first of all, Commander Dredge, when you first went to Hong Kong, which year was it?
1923.
How did you come to get your posting there?
Well, I asked for it in the informal way you can do in a naval world. I let it be known that I was very anxious to do some service in China.
Why did you want to go there so much?
I've been fascinated by the Chinese. Most wonderful men, most wonderful women.
Had you been reading about China? Or had you had some family contact?
No, it simply grew up in me. It was there, so to speak. I always wanted to get to know China.
Was it easy to get a posting to China?
What?
Was it easy to get a posting to China?
Well, yes. I mean, they were very... In those days, all events, they were very obliging in the Admiralty. They knew a chap would work much harder at something he liked and something he didn't like. And they do their best to help you. It's a smaller world in every way then.
What was the name of the vessel to which you were posted?
Bluebell.
What kind of a ship was it?
A sloop, which was, in the wartime, they were minesweepers. In peacetime, they were admirable, dirty work ships. They could do anything. They had a crew of about 90 and 6 officers. And the armament was 2 4-inch guns and 2 pom-poms. And 4 saluting, 6-pound saluting guns. So we always planned, if it ever came to anything rough, to go alongside, let fly with all the pom-poms and 6-pounders, as well as the 4-inch guns, and try and board, the only thing we had any hope for, because we had no firepower.
What kind of speed could it do?
We knew it did more than 12. I'm sure it might have gone faster sometime, but I very much doubt it. They were on the cheap ships, built as minesweepers and converted into sloops for general purpose. Our main job was protecting British concession on the coast. You know, Swatow, Amoy, Fuchao, Ningpo, and so on. We'd go there and land apart if they were threatened or attacked by the local Chuchan, the local Chinese general.
The local what?
Tuchun, Chuchan. Local military commander. And we'd land a party of sailors with old Ross rifles and so on and try to protect the people there. But we did most of it by diplomacy, by getting on with the Chinese. The worst place was Swatow, which is quite understandable, because in the old day, a short time ago, it was the basis for the slave trade. People called the Blackbird used to kidnap Chinese coolies from there to force service on plantations in Southeast Asia.
People called what?
Well, the nickname, Blackbirders.
Blackbirders.
Blackbird.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What nationality were these Blackbirders?
All kinds. Probably some were British anyway. But I don't know. I can't tell you much about that. But that was the reason for the great hostility shown by the Swatow people towards all foreigners.
Did you have personal contact with this hostility? Were there any instances that you can quote?
Well, yes, they poisoned the wells once. All kinds of things like that. There's plenty of hostility. We wouldn't have been there if there hadn't been. One difficulty about Swatow was there was no foreign concession. Most places on the coast, we'd bully the Chinese, if you like, into setting up a foreign concession, which was British territory, and so we had some powers there.
When you said they poisoned a well, you mean this was a well used by the Royal Navy?
No, by the people on shore. It only happened once. They didn't often do things like that. But it's a complicated life because It's a Chinese sovereignty, you see. And the senior official is, of course, the Commissioner of Customs. And he was nearly always British. So he had to fight himself in many ingenious manners. The great thing was to keep your temper. And the other side always appreciate the joke.
Can you give any examples of their sense of humour?
I'd have to think about that. It's all a very long time ago, you see.
But coming back to this well, you mean it was this a well used by foreigners in Swatow?
By the people in the concession, yes. It only happened once, sir. But that's about the worst thing they did, I think. Our servants got attacked and beaten up sometime on shore. And you heard the old cry, Chow Chai, you know, kill the foreigner, and that sort of thing. But I had a very good captain, Smithick, who kept his head and kept the thing on a low key the whole time. When we finally left there to go and pay off, all our great enemy was the so-called the Bolshevik boat. It's just a motorboat belonging to customs and seized by the Chinese and strikers. And we had a long-term war with it. We always try and catch them trying to board British ships and so on. And when we finally left, they knew we were going, they always knew everything like that. The Bolshevik boat came, was caught to the down harbour cheering and saying, "Very sorry you go, come back soon," and so on.
This was the Chinese customs boat?
Yes, but manned and seized by Chinese strikers. I don't wonder you're puzzled. We're very puzzled ourselves very often.
You said that earlier that your servants were beaten up. Were these Chinese people working for you?
Chinese servants, yes. The worst thing they ever did was to capture one of them, not from my ship, another ship, and make them eat bowls of dry rice, and then force them to drink soda water. And the boy said, "And soda water, rice swell up and burst them belly." But things weren't often as bad as that.
Did you actually see this, or did you hear
about it? No, the man had been captured, been taken away. No, we were told about it.
Did you find his body?
No.
When you got your posting to Bluebell, did you find the ship very seaworthy or not?
No, it's fallen to bits. He'd been built, as a minesweeper in the war, on a very quick build. And used for a few years and throw away. So she's in very bad condition. We had very long refits. Seemed to try to hold her together.
Was the refit effective?
What?
Was the refit effective?
Effective? Oh, up to a point, yes. I wasn't on board then, because as soon as we went to refit, I went off to be ADC as the governor. Which is a very interesting job.
Was this in 1923 that you became ADC?
Yes.
Who was the governor then?
Stubbs, Reginald Stubbs.
What kind of a man was he?
Well, I think I told you about him, and we marked on one occasion. He'd never, in all his governorships over different parts of the empire, he'd never yet received any orders from the Foreign Office, which he thought were good enough to be worth following, be worth obeying. That, I think, really describes a man more than a great many, great deal description.
Why were you chosen to be ADC?
Oh, it's a bit of luck. Now, wait a minute. Yes. An old chap, I think in the Saltgabelle, who became a friend of my father, was a friend of Stubbs. And Stubbs wanted an ADC, and he got my name. And he heard about me. No, he'd... And when I was Bluebell, when I came to join the Blue, he asked me to have lunch with him. I suppose he took a liking to me. His ADC was going on leave, and so he took me for the job.
What did your duties involve?
My dear fellow, what does an ADC do? He arranges the seats at dinner parties, which is the most important thing because there's a great deal of protocol and precedence in a place like Hong Kong. And if you get Mrs. So-and-so one place lower, he turns up very nasty. And one thing, my mother and father came out to stay with the governor later on, and every night my mother got a little note from the ADC telling her what colour the table decoration was going to be. He'd been deeply offended by some lady who wore a coloured dress which clashed with decoration on the table. That's been a good ADC, of course. He was a very good one. Probably the best one in the Empire. God, his name. He was a Royal Marine. Neville. Captain Neville.
How long did your work as ADC last?
Oh, only a few months, 3 or 4 months. Then the Bluebell refit finished, and I rejoined her, and we went off to sea on a southern cruise.
Whilst you were doing the job as ADC, what impression did you get of the life of the civilians in Hong Kong?
Very luxurious. People who'd never had a servant in their life had not less than 3. In fact, you couldn't have less if you didn't have enough servants to suit your head boy's estimate of his position. He'd get a couple of servants himself.
You mean to pay at his own expense?
Well, I don't know, he probably didn't pay them. The feed them quite enough, you see. Life was very hard for the lower orders in China. They starved by the million.
Did you see evidence of starvation?
No. I couldn't produce first-hand. But I know from what the boys told me and what their families told me and so on.
What was the relationship like between the European civilians in China and the Chinese?
Well, that's a very big question. You now raised the whole question of Chinese attitude to the foreigner, which is fairly hostile. One thing, we smell foul to them. I don't quite know why. Maybe because they never eat beef. The buffalo is sort of semi-sacred to them. And of course, we eat beef. We certainly do smell absolutely foully. Our habit of showing our feeling by our expression is against all their code of good behaviour. They describe our face looking like something being buried and dug up again. And instead, our existence is offensive to them. You must remember, China got a peculiar outlook. China is a middle kingdom to them. It's a large island of civilization surrounded by surging waters of barbarism.
Did you ever come across any experiences to show this Chinese sense of xenophobia?
Well, yes, though. The whole of 1924 and 25 was an example of that. There was a very badly handled shooting incident on the Xiamen at the British concession in Canton, you know, the great capital of southern China. And a general boycott and, attack on the British was instigated and carried off fairly effectively. So we dashed madly up and down the coast from one place to the other, usually getting out too late, and trying to protect the British, who were all there for commercial reasons.
Can you describe to me exactly what you saw during this Canton incident? Can you tell me what you actually saw?
No, because in between the two was the building of the Xiamen. The Xiamen was an island built up out of the mud and surrounded by a bund on which all the foreigners left. And that and this built and trees. It's a beautiful place. It was between ours and the far side where the shooting took place.
How many casualties were sustained during the shooting?
Heaven knows. Who could possibly tell you that? They carried their bodies away. It was begun by a protest march across the far side, watched by our blue jacket who were protecting the Xiamen, and the last group of men suddenly wheeled about and opened fire. They were what they call Wampo cadets, very highly trained and highly motivated young men. This is the day, of course, of the day of Sun Yat-sen, the greatest man I've ever known. who, of course, had a love-hate relationship with the British.
Did you actually meet Sun Yat-sen?
Oh, only once.
Can you tell me what the circumstances were when you met him?
Yes, Tugan Khoen took me to see him.
Who was Tugan Khoen?
Oh, well, a rather famous character. He was Sun Yat-sen's bodyguard. Later on, he commanded large forces, of course, and so on, became a great figure. The only man I've ever seen my wife kiss in public. He was a very, very nice chap, and he blushed like a debutante at her first dance. He was an awfully nice, well, one of my greatest friends. He's dead now. I wrote his life, actually.
What nationality was he?
Cockney Jewish. But when fairly young, he went to Canada. He always had a Canadian accent. You'd really, a little bit of wasting your time now, because I say you can read the whole story in my book.
So, how did you come to meet Sun Yat-sen?
I see him one day. And so Sun Khoen took me along very humbly to be presented.
Can you tell me what Sun Yat-sen looked like?
Yes, that I have often thought about. You'd like nothing so much as the colonel of a very good line regiment. A little military moustache, very erect, very quiet, very polite, spoke very little, and very much to the point. But I often thought about it, and that is the best picture I can give of him. He could have commanded the Sherwood Foresters, you know, or something like that.
Did he seem to be a confident man?
In his own destiny, yes. In his duty to save China.
Could he speak English?
Perfectly. And heaven knows how many other languages, too.
Did he speak English with an English or American accent?
English, not American.
What kind of dress did he wear when you met him?
A non-military dress, a tunic. A tunic and trousers.
What kind of building did you meet him in?
In his yamen.
In where?
His yamen, his office. But I was very lucky, of course, because Khoen was his bodyguard, and therefore a man of great privileges.
What did Khoen himself look like?
A Jew. But a very, very effective... Look here, a little bit of wasting your time now, because the whole thing is there are new constant pictures of him in that book of mine. But I'm glad to talk, only a little bit wasting your run over here.
Okay. Now, you said that you went to Canton for the customs crisis there.
Yes.
How long did that duty involve you in? Was it a matter of weeks?
Oh, no,
weeks
or months. Sun Yat-sen ran short of money, so he seized the customs. The Chinese customs are a rather remarkable organization because it effectively governed China. For 40 years, China was governed, I'm talking at random now, but it is all true, by three people. There was the old Buddha, you know, the famous old Empress of Japan, of China. There was Sir Robert Hart, the head of the Scots, head of the customs. And there was the great viceroy, China's Bismarck, Li Hung Chao. Lihungchow. And they effectively governed China. 60 million, well, 100 million people.
Can I ask you what the attitude of you and your brother officers was to the situation in Chinese politics in the first half of the 20s?
Well, we were simply there to protect British lives and property. And as long as the local general didn't get too tough, we were happy to let it go on. We had no mission to reform China.
But what was the attitude of you and your brother officers, for example, towards Sun Yat-sen and what he was trying to do in China?
Profound respect. He was certainly trying to drive rivals out of China, but that was, after all, his business. But he was a most impressive man to meet.
Did you ever meet any of the other great Chinese leaders, like Chiang Kai-shek?
Oh, yes, I met him. And I met, of course, the famous three sisters, who were Americans, American extraction, from Wellesley College. Chiang Kai-shek's wife, of Christ, Chiang Kai-shek's wife, the wife of the minister for the finance minister, Hung, I think. That bit has gone.
What impression did you get of Chiang Kai-shek? Can you describe his appearance and his character?
His appearance was rather like one of my great friends out there. You see, was a Junker, an old Prussian officer who nearly strangled Hitler, and then rather wisely left Germany and went to China. And he always described him as the typical product of the Prussian Staff College. Essentially military, very dignified, alert, and very, very clever. Well, are you getting the stuff you want?
Yes, certainly. But what was his actual physical appearance?
You better look at his picture for that. I could give you a shot at it.
When was it that you met Chiang Kai-shek?
Now, wait a minute. I had to think about it. You were asking for the first time. I met him. He was a great figure in Chinese history over a great many years. I'd have to think back sometime. I couldn't really tell you that. He was driven out in the end, of course, and set up his government in Formosa, you know, the great big island.
Now, in 1924, you took part in a cruise to Southeast Asia, to Singapore, the Dutch East Indies, and Siam. Can you tell me why that cruise was necessary?
Well, they call it showing a flag, I suppose. We appear at these places. We entertain the British colony. As an intelligence officer, I looked into things a bit and wrote a report on it and so on. We supported the British Consul General, whoever it was. We were generally welcomed and tried to make ourselves liked as far as we could and put on a good show. I say showing a flag sounds awfully pompous, but it was a very important part of our duties.
Did you get any impression whilst you were in the Dutch East Indies of Dutch rule?
Yes, I did indeed a lot. I thought a lot about that. They were, on the whole, better than we were. For one thing, there was no colour bar. It rather helped you to be dark-skinned. And, of course, the Java intermarriage was encouraged, and the Javanese most attractive women. And one got to remember they were governing a place about as big as India in total territorial extension, or nearly, and certainly almost as big in population. And they did that with a very, very small force. They had some submarines there just to keep the Japanese on their toes, and cruisers, and there it was. Of course, it was easier because you controlling sea communications, you could stop the interchange of revolutionary movement, revolutionary figures and so on.
I think later on, when you returned to the Dutch East Indies later in 1924 or 25, when you went on a cruise to Makassar and North Borneo, Labuan, and that area,
yes,
there was a Dutch naval mutiny.
There was indeed, yes.
Can
it's
you
a
tell
very
me?
Mysterious business, because one thing, a Dutch has a strong force of submarines out there, and submarines didn't often mutiny, because their men were so close to the officers. And no one knew very much what happened. It came into my life, because you know I wrote gave a lecture on mutinies, and I wasn't interested in mutinies. And it's a very hard thing to understand. They finished up with bombing the flagship from aircraft.
The mutineers bombed the flagship?
No, the Royal Air Force did. Flagship having led the mutiny.
How much of the mutiny did you see personally?
Oh, none.
Did you arrive after it was all over?
Well, no, it took part in different parts of the East Indies. The East Indies, it's an enormous area, mind you. Have you ever had a look? If you look at the globe, you can see what it really was.
Whilst you were in the Dutch East Indies, did the behaviour of the Dutch in the Dutch East Indies seem to be very similar to the behaviour of the British in their colonies, apart from the things you've already said?
Yes, it was a benevolent government, very shrewd government, and in their case, of course, altered normally by encouragement of intermarriage. So most of the officials had coloured blood. Whereas we, of course, were very much against that, I think wrongly, but it's a matter of opinion.
What was the relationship like between the Dutch and the British?
Oh, they were naturally very close. They entertained us, and we did what we could for them.
Was there ever any sense of rivalry between the two?
No. There was plenty of room for both people, both lots of people there.
In 1924, on a cruise to Swatow and Amoy, you gave some assistance to a grounded civilian ship. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, the Glen Amoy. It's not quite there, it's farther up the coast, not very far from Shanghai. Oh, we put a guard on board to keep the ubiquitous pirates away. We tried to get her off by towing. The Bluebell, of course, had been a very well fitted out for towing, and one thing and another, but you didn't get her off. And in the end, we had to go on and do something else.
Had the pirates plundered the ship?
What?
Did the pirates actually get onto the ship?
No. But they watched proceedings top of a nearby cliff, and we saw their little craft, very fast little dhows about, junks about.
Did you ever engage in hostilities with pirates at any time whilst you served in the Far East?
No, we didn't, not actual shooting, but other ships did, though.
When you saw them on top of this cliff, yeah. Was that the only time you saw pirates?
No, we saw them in their junks round about, too. They had very fast-sailing junks, and we were a very slow old ship, and we had very bad coal. And once we were rammed up the stern by a fast-sailing junk. We couldn't believe we were going so slowly. It involved a nice point of nautical law, because on one hand, the overtaking ship should give way. And on the other, of course, a sailing ship, a steamship.